May it please the court and counsel. I would like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal. The majority of the issues are on the cross appeal.
Very well.
My appeal is only that Judge Doyle failed to grant a motion for default judgment after the defendant John Probandt had failed to make an appearance. But I'm afraid it's going to have to be remanded because although he was served and we did prove our damages, we had alternative theories. And one of our theories was, and on this one, this court could enter the default judgment or enter the amount. We proved that Mr. Probandt had taken in excess of $2 million from the company that he was not entitled to. And evidence of that was presented to the court.
And clarify for me, what issue would require remand?
He misrecollected the damages on the promissory note that was originally signed and is the basis for the other issues in this appeal. Mr. Probandt represented that he was going to sign it, and our client, in reliance on that, signed the note. The note also paid off a prior note of $1.3 million. So our conflicting requests were either Mr. Probandt was enriched in the amount of $1.3 million damages, in which case our relief would be the $1.3 million plus interest from the date that the judgment was entered, or rather the date that the $1.3 million was paid, or he is jointly and severally liable on the promissory note. And that's an amount something in excess of $2 million. So although he was clearly in default, and we proved the damages under both his misappropriation and the other theories, I believe the trial court is going to have to say which theory is more supported by the law.
Did you not limit your motion for default at the hearing? When I read through the record, you indicated that there's a separate cause of action against Mr. Probandt for misappropriation of funds, and this default judgment goes only to that cause of action.
At that time, yes. And then that we were asking for default at that time on that motion, and we did not have the other evidence. The other evidence was presented at trial.
And so did you ever move for a default judgment on the other on the other cause of action?
Yes. In the Bill of Exceptions, there was discussion when we submitted the, if my recollection is correct, when we submitted the depositions of Mr. Hansen and Mr. Herz in support of our request for damages.
And their testimony on damages went to the second cause of action? I think it was cause of action 2 and cause of action 4.
Yes.
Right? Misappropriation. So their testimony, their deposition testimony, did that go to the fraud and misrepresentation cause of action or the other?
That went to the fraud and misrepresentation. It was at the trial that we had the testimony of the bank president, whose name I am blanking on at this moment, and he established the amount of the note that was left, and he established that the $1.3 million was paid to Five Points Bank on a date certain.
Okay. Thank you.
If you have no other questions, I'll
you can reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal. Thank you. Morning, Mr. Hang.
Good morning, Your Honors. Please the court, Ms. Vogt, my name is Pat Hang. I'm an attorney with the Waite McWall Law Firm here in North Platte, Nebraska. And I'm agreed to represent the appellant, John Rayner, on the appeal and the briefing on the appeal. I did not try the case. I was representing a separate party. With permission of that party, I was able to appear before the court on this issue. The nature of the argument here is kind of as nature of the crazy nature of this case. As the court probably looking back through the record, this case was filed, I think, in February of 2009 by First State Bank on a note and a replevin action in Dawson County District Court. The note involved Mr. Rayner, the appellant, Mr. Walker, one of the appellees, and the other signers of the note. In his answer, Mr. Walker attacked the enforceability of the note. I think he had at least 8 different reasons that both personal to him and just in general as to the enforceability of the note, including the fact that Mr. Proben hadn't signed the note, the fact the bank didn't do a number of items it should have done in order to make the note enforceable, as well as a misrepresentation of bank shareholders in getting the parties to enforce the note. So the case starts off as that, as well as then Mr. Walker has brought in a number of other people for a number of other causes of action in his counterclaim. At some point in time, a couple years later, Mr. Walker turns around and buys the same note that he's been attacking as unenforceable the whole time, and then turns around and then sues under that note, saying now that he's gone from defendant Walker, he becomes plaintiff Walker, and apparently all, and we talked about in the brief about the fact he raises these issues, attacking the enforceability note, and then turns around then and enforces the note despite having all these issues with the note.
Mr. Hing, can you answer what I thought should be a very simple question, but I'm not sure I can figure out the answer. If we add together the amount of money that was paid by Mr. Walker to First State Bank and the amount of the judgment entered against Mr. Rayner, is that amount greater than what was owed on the note?
Based on the testimony of Mr. Randecker, who is the president of the bank, the amount that was owed was testified to. The amount of the judgment, there are settlements that occurred during the nature of this case with third parties that Judge Doyle did not take into account.
And right. So if we just take what Mr. Walker paid and what the judgment against Mr. Rayner,
correct,
is that more than the amount that was owed on the note when First State Bank first brought the case?
It would be at that time, yes. At the time in 2009, that is correct. Because, I mean, we're talking interest and things,
right,
items like that. Yes,
okay.
At the time of the note, and I don't recall in 2009 what the amount First State Bank was claiming was owed on the note, but yes, the amount that in the final judgment award, much greater than that.
So when the bank president testifies at the beginning of trial that the amount owed on the note is, I think it was $1.4 million?
That's correct. That'd be the principal amount.
Pardon me?
That, I believe that was the principal amount.
In principal amount.
Yes.
That didn't take into account that the bank had been paid by Mr. Walker, or did it?
It did not. It would not have, because at that point in time, the note would have been purchased by Mr. Walker, and I think in the stipulation of facts, it's like $1,050,000 had been paid by Mr. Walker at some point in time prior to that testimony at trial, yes.
So, asking it one more time, perhaps a different way, the
by
judgment
answer,
entered by the district court did not take into account that settlement.
It would not have, no. It would. All that would have taken into account was the, based on whenever the note was in default, the principal amount plus all interest had accrued from 2009 until the trial was, I guess it concluded in late 2015, I believe. So that is correct.
Okay, so. Thank you.
So have you ascertained what the correct amount should have been?
Pardon?
So have you ascertained what the correct amount should have been?
Well, Mr. Rayner's position is that the correct amount is zero against him, so I have not done that, Your Honor. So turning again, and
so what's your best argument, Mr. Hang, that Mr. Rayner should be liable for nothing?
Well, I think the first argument would be the argument under UCC 3-419 under the accommodation argument. I think that it states that if an instrument is issued for value given for the benefit of party to the instrument, an accommodated party. And I think clearly in this case, Mr. Walker is an accommodated party. The note benefited him from a standpoint of going through the history. There was the original 5 points bank note from 2002 that was taken out by First State Bank in 2008. That note relieved Walker of that liability, as well as giving him additional funds for the companies, which in essence he was owning by that time. He's in control of, he's in charge of, and he was the money behind those notes. Mr. Rayner signed that note in 2008 with 5 points bank. Basically, stipulated by the party that for sole basis him doing so was help a third party, Mark Hertz, who was a signature on the note. And that was the sole reason he signed that note. Mr. Rayner had filed bankruptcy in 2004. the Five Points Bank had been, note had been discharged from him, so it wasn't exposed, he was not exposed on that existing indebtedness. At that time, he realized they could, or shortly thereafter, had forfeited all, I think the bankruptcy court concluded, he had no further interest in ANG, which is the underlying company. And so, I think, and Judge Doyle, in his order, kind of concludes that John Rayner is, he's an accommodated party, and by being an accommodation party, and by being an accommodation party, I guess when you look at 3-419E, if an accommodation party purchases that instrument or acquires that instrument, they cannot come back, accommodate party purchase the instrument, they cannot come back around and make a claim against an accommodation party.
But in this case, the party was Skyline.
Correct.
So in order to adopt your argument, we first have to find that Skyline is the alter ego of Mr. Walker, correct?
That's correct.
What evidence in the record is there of that?
Well, I think the evidence, as you go through the timeline of this case, Skyline Acquisitions doesn't show up until trial time. In fact, this case had been up on an appeal prior and remanded because of not a final order on all parties, and Mr. Hansen and Mr. Hertz were one of those parties. A separate settlement had been entered into separately. So that came back down, and what came back after the remand was that in 2015-ish, whenever this settlement with Hertz and Hansen was entered into, Skyline was not part of that settlement. So it wasn't part of in existence, at least it may be in existence, but it was not part of this a case that it had been assigned to. So then finally, I think during the trials when it was finally added to the party. So I think as to the hard evidence as to what it did, I think it basically becomes a situation where, you know, it's form over substance. Yeah, they created an entity whenever it created it, but essentially then assign these rights under the note, Walker assigned these rights under the note for purposes of then we get the judgment and we don't have that direct link. I mean, there's no other reason at that stage of the proceedings that Skyline Acquisition is added to the equation because...
Well, the assignment to Skyline, is that from Walker or is that from First State Bank?
That would have been the part of the agreement with Walker and First State Bank was that Walker could designate who First State Bank was to assign that note to. And so at some point in time prior to the final verdict or final judgment by Judge Doyle, that decision was made, and that's when they were added to that party. I don't think the record has when it was made, but Walker had that ability to say, hey, I want to who I can assign this to. He didn't, back in 2011, obviously did not do that, but because then Skyline would have been added. Skyline would have been added to the Hertz-Hansen settlement documents. They were not a party at that time when Hertz and Hansen were settling with the plaintiffs.
So the assignment that's in the record from First State Bank, does that say First State Bank assigns to Walker or First State Bank assigns to Skyline?
The agreement was Walker designated who First State Bank would assign to, and so he must have designated First State Bank assigned to Skyline Acquisitions.
Okay.
If there's nothing
else. So if we do not find the alter ego theory, then the issue of accommodated doesn't come into play, right? Because that's only as between, you know, that doesn't apply to the lender. The lender can go after the accommodated party or the accommodation party.
As to the lender, that is correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Is that it?
I think so.
Did I answer it?
Yes. Thank you.
Is there a particular issue you would like to start with?
We'll let you decide. I think the accommodation issue, it seems to be the most discussed so far, so perhaps you start with that.
Well, in terms of an accommodation party, first of all, the decision on whether or not someone is an accommodation party is a question of fact. And Judge Doyle determined that Mr. Walker was not the accommodated party, and therefore, in relationship to him, Mr. Rayner was not an accommodation party, and therefore, that issue was not relevant. Because that was a finding of fact made by the trial court, that has to be clearly wrong. And we believe that under the circumstances, it was not clearly wrong. Mr. Rayner freely admitted that the bank was more concerned about the credit of Mr. Walker signing the note. So to the extent anyone was an accommodated party, it might have been Mark Hurst, whose livelihood was on the line with this business, but it was not Mr. Walker. Going back to the assignment issue, Skyline was actually involved prior to trial. The assignment took place quite a long time before trial, but because in Nebraska you can sue under the name of the assignor or the assignee, and we were anticipating a jury trial that later switched to a bench trial. And so Skyline was not substituted in as the named party for First State Bank because we were hoping to avoid that extra layer of explanation if we were going to go in front of a jury. Mm. But at trial, they were substituted in accordance with the facts that were shown, including the assignment that was admitted into evidence. So that's the only reason that Skyline did not appear in the pleadings earlier.
Do you, going back to the amount, and I'm going to take your argument of let's not complicate it by layering. So I'm going to just talk about First State Bank. If First State Bank was still the holder, the amount of money awarded to First State Bank, when you take into the amount of the judgment against Mr. Rayner and the amount of money paid by Mr. Walker, is that more than what was owed on the note?
Yes.
How can that be? How can a bank recover more than what's owed to it?
Well, the bank did not recover on that. I mean, the judgment is in favor of Mr. Walker, or I mean in Skyline, based on the fact that it is a negotiable instrument. And once one entity takes it over, they are entitled to enforce for the full value of the note.
Even if part of the note has been paid?
The bank would get a windfall if the money were going to the bank, but the money is going to Skyline.
But can't you only assign, if a note is $100 and 50 of it's been paid, and the bank gets the 50 and then it assigns the note to another party, aren't its rights only those that the bank would have had for the other 50?
Yes.
So how, when we add it all together, do they get to collect 150?
Because the bank is not collecting it. It's being collected by Skyline, which is only collecting the amount of the note. Mr. Rayner has paid nothing on the note. It was purchased for an amount by Mr. Walker plus future consideration depending on whether we prevail in the lawsuit ultimately or not and succeed in collecting any further money. So Mr. Walker put out money to the bank, and the bank agreed to assign the note for that partial amount.
But they assigned the whole note.
Yes, they assigned the whole note.
So the bank actually took a loss.
Yes, the bank took a loss. But they also got rid of...
Right.
They were able to pay the other banks that had a participation in it and
remove that. It was to their benefit.
Yes, it was to their benefit.
The mutual benefit.
Yes.
In theory.
So what we have here is an issue that I could not find addressed under Nebraska law. We do have the cases where it says, okay, one signature on a note cannot take it and then enforce it for the full amount. But in this case, there was an entity, and the entity, both Diana and Denny Walker, are the owners of Skyline. So it's not just one of the signatures on the note who is trying to enforce it against one of the other notes.
But can you do that? Can you, I mean, if it was Mr. Walker, he could not do it. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
So by setting up a different entity, because the money was not paid from Skyline to the bank, was it?
No.
It was paid from Mr. Walker to the bank.
Yes, and part
of his... So how can Mr. Walker then create a another entity and convey his interest to that entity in order to collect the money. It looks like that would be a problem.
Well, you know, and that kind of goes into where do we draw the line? Because banks or different entities all the time purchase negotiable instruments for less than they are worth and then take the time and effort to enforce them against, you know, in full against a party who's liable on it. So this is sort of a new instance.
Well, but I understood that since Mr. Walker was a guarantee of the note, that he could not do this personally.
That's correct.
And if he couldn't do it personally, how can he do it using another entity that he's created?
Well, we believe...
Is there a law, is there a case that says that that's okay, or is there...
Not in Nebraska.
I'm glad to hear that, because I wasn't aware of it.
So. No, there isn't, and then that just gets us back to the issue of where do you draw the line, and that there was no no evidence that showed that it was an alter ego or not a viable corporation.
Yeah, was there any? What was the evidence as to what Skyline was, other than it was owned by Mr. Walker and his wife?
There was nothing presented at trial.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you both. You are excused and your case is submitted. Thank you for appearing today. Next case this morning is Wisner versus Vandalay Investments. Morning, Mr. Peters.